This is the Education Gadfly Show.
We do dress up around here.
We're dressing up.
All right.
Is there a memo for that type of thing?
Halloween
memo?
No, it's just understood in the Fordham culture, you show up in something on Halloween.
Well, I guess you don't want to come up in nothing at all.
Yeah. Now, here's your host.
Hi, this is your host, Darizy Handelar of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Sitting in for the esteemed Mike Petrelli as he gallivants across the country, bringing the good word about the Common Core. And now, please join me in welcoming my apparently Halloween-hating co-host, Michael Brickman.
Yeah, Halloween, not my favorite. Happy to be here on the podcast, though. And, you know, Mike's in Wausau, Wisconsin, which is the home of the mythical Hodag, which is kind of like a monster dragon thing. So being there right around Halloween, I don't know. He might have to watch out. He might not make it back.
Wait, so can we go back, though, to the Halloween hating thing?
Is no, we're just costume? Passing over that.
No, I want to know. Is it the costumes? Is it the candy? Is it the children? Is it the commercialization of something? Is it, what is it?
Yeah, we'll go with that. I believe in the spirit of Halloween, but it's just been so over-commercialized. No, I love Thanksgiving. It's just kind of the precursor to a way better holiday where you get to eat way better food. I'm more of a good food person than sweets and candy.
Fair enough. Although I do welcome the pumpkin spice latte every time it comes for Halloween and Thanksgiving. All right. Now it is time to play Pardon the Gadfly. Question number one.
Brickman, earlier this week, you wrote a blog post arguing that Michigan's lawmakers may have found a winning legislative strategy for keeping the Common Core in a state experiencing a wave of opposition to the standards. What is that strategy? And is it replicable in other states?
Yeah, I think it is. It's really interesting. I think in June, NPR came out with a piece and said that Michigan might be the exemplar state for getting rid of the Common Core. And now they seem to be the exemplar state for keeping it, which is pretty interesting. They still have to figure out some things with the assessments. That's definitely not a done deal. I think the state board will be coming out with a report in December, and they'll have to figure out where they go with assessments from there. But with the House passing this week, a resolution that was already passed by the Senate, they're in a much better place. And I think that what they really did was, rather than be dismissive of some of the concerns that are out there about the Common Core, even some of the ones that I think most people would say are a little bit outside the mainstream, they put those things, package them together, and you actually read the resolution, and it talks about indoctrination. It talks about data collection on religious and political beliefs, guaranteeing those things won't be in there. Now, we all know they weren't going to be in there in the first place, but rest assured, if you are a Common Core critic who believes those things, Michigan has put your mind at ease.
So is this almost model legislation? I mean, can other states get away with this piece of legislation that seems kind of half law and half PR?
I don't know about that exactly. I mean, there are other states that are kind of going down this road. Alabama, they have different concerns. One of the big concerns there is the question of who actually owns the standards. And so they're redoing, it seems, their MOU. Louisiana, they have a different set of concerns. And so their state board has acted accordingly. And so I think it's not a totally one-size-fits-all solution. It has more to do with what the specific concerns are in each state, and you take it from there and try to address those and be as reasonable as you can.
So I think then that maybe you agree that if there's a lesson here, it is really get a good understanding of the opposition, and you might find out that these so-called deal killer issues can be dealt with quite easily or systematically as long as you know what they are.
And it's a lot easier if they're not true, but that's a whole other story.
That helps as well. All right, Pamela, question number two.
After a week of insider chatter predicting that LA Schools Chief John Deasy would resign, he was given a satisfactory evaluation from the LA Unified Board of Education. What's the story and what's next for LA schools?
Dara, you're from this neck of the woods. What's going on?
I not only went to graduate school in Los Angeles, but I'm a product of LAUSD all through first through 12th grade. So yes, I love talking about this stuff. But without going into too much detail about what's actually going on, this is kind of the same old story. You have turnover among the board. You have competitive school board elections, and you have a strong union and a strong mayor. So sometimes the mayor has the majority on the board. Sometimes the union has the majority on the board. And if the majority happens to pick the superintendent and then becomes the minority, then the new board majority is going to want to choose something else. So this is nothing really new. And it happens in LA all the time. And in fact, it happens in major cities all the time. In large districts, we're talking high student enrollment. The average tenure of a superintendent is between 2 and 3 years. So there is a super high degree of turnover in all these large districts because things get super political. What's going on in particular in LA, DC is getting flack for buying students iPads, for a teacher evaluation program, for a student breakfast program that the teacher union really opposed. So there are a lot of things to criticize. Last week, they said he was going to resign. This week, he gets a satisfactory evaluation, which is an automatic contract renewal. So he's not going to resign. He's going to be there through 2016. Pushing all of that aside, though, I think that this reveals a huge tension between boards and superintendents in general. And it begs the question, what is more important, leadership continuity or representativeness? Should a school board, even if they don't think that a superintendent is doing a good job, keep the superintendent? Because if you kick him out and bring someone else in, you have to start all over. And I don't think there's a good answer to that question.
Well, it's a good point that you make about the tenure. It's, first of all, really hard to follow through on your vision if you're only there for a couple school years. But also, in that short of a time period, it's hard to hold people accountable for anything other than really submitting to the will of what the board wants. And then it becomes about power play politics rather than about, is education actually getting better for the kids? So it's kind of unfortunate.
And I think, you know, this is something that comes up all the time. And even in federal politics, is 2 years too short of a term to get anything done? Is two four-year terms enough for a United States president? Is a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court too much? And so it's this same kind of issue that is boiling down to the local level. But, you know, from a personal standpoint, and also from my experience as a teacher, recognizing that it is so important that your board appears to support your administrator and that you believe that your board is not out there to play politics and that they recognize that they might not agree with the administrator on all fronts, but the board hired the administrator, so they need to stand behind him unless he royally, royally messes up. On that, question number three, off my soapbox.
A report from the Brookings Institution found that even if the states with strong Common Core opposition dropped out of the testing consortia, the price of assessments would only rise around $2 to $3 per student. What's more, the study argued that states going it alone would be hard-pressed to develop a cheaper and higher quality test. Is this likely to change the dialogue on Common Core?
I think yes and no. On the one hand, you have states that are considering whether or not they want to drop out of PARC and Smarter Balanced, and I think for proponents, it really takes a little bit of the edge off of it, where if one state drops, it's not necessarily going to send prices through the roof. So, you know, maybe it doesn't matter quite as much if a couple of states drop out in terms of pricing. Now, you can still make the arguments about the value of the tests, and if not PARC and Smarter Balanced, then what? But on the other hand, I don't know that one state is going to necessarily have it play into their calculus at all, that it might hurt other states. So even if a study came out and said, well, this is just going to kill other states if a couple states drop out, I don't know that, frankly, a lot of states and a lot of legislators who really want their state out of PARC and Smarter Balanced, their neighbors, unfortunately, I don't know that's really going to make a difference to them.
Well, I would be shocked if any state that drops out of the consortium manages to provide the same level of testing and feedback for less money by doing it on their own. One of the points of the Brookings report was that the consortium are benefiting from economy of scale. So any state that drops out of this, they have two choices. Provide, because PARC and Smarter Balanced aren't just doing end of course assessments or end of year assessments. They're doing midterm assessments. They're providing teacher feedback. So it's a lot more than just a piece of paper. But one of the points of the Brookings report is that if a state for whatever reason chooses to not do this, they really have two options. Provide the same services and it's going to cost them more money to do the exact same thing, or they're going to have to spend less money and they're going to get less because they're not enjoying the economy of scale.
Yeah, I think in assessments, you get what you pay for. And I certainly agree that while of the 10,000 plus that we spend per pupil, there's a lot of waste in there that could be dealt with. But I think the few bucks that we spend on assessments, essentially the quality control for all that money we spend in education, is probably money that's well spent. But unfortunately, on the left, you have people who don't believe in assessments at all and would rather we spend $0. And on the right, you have people who just really look at the bottom line and don't necessarily see the value in spending a little bit more on assessments so you can get more return on your overall investment in terms of academic outcomes.
Right. And let's be real here. We're talking about $40 a year on tests compared to $10,000 in per pupil spending. Mm-hmm. And again, I hate to keep pulling out the as a former teacher card, but I like to know how my students are doing. And I didn't trust my ability to write a super awesome end of course exam. I want to know how they are doing on the things that I am supposed to be teaching them. And, how do you do it? I'm sorry, you test them. And that is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Up next, everybody's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Daryl.
Any Halloween plans? Knowing that apparently Brickman hates Halloween.
Oh,
and
man.
I love it.
We are dressing up tomorrow, right?
We are.
I haven't seen a memo, but we do dress up around here.
We're dressing up.
All right.
Is there a memo for that type of thing?
Halloween
memo?
No, it's just understood in the Fordham culture. You show up in something on Halloween.
Well, I guess tonight. You don't want to come up in nothing at all.
That would be scary. We do not want birthday suits as the Halloween costume. So. Anywho, I'm going to be working Halloween. I am. I'm going to be giving out candy. I'm going to be dressed up. I'm working it.
I missed Halloween in D.C. last year because I was stranded out of town for Hurricane Sandy. Mm. So I am excited. I carved pumpkins this year. I spent about $80 in candy because
wow.
We have a lot of kids in our neighborhood.
Are you going to let us know what you're coming as tomorrow or are we going to have to wait?
No, you have to wait.
We have to wait. All right. I'm the most just non-creative person. I think I was a cowgirl rather last year. Just stuck a cowboy hat on.
Well, I've let Brickman know that I have an entire closet full of Halloween costumes if he is at a loss for creativity.
Right.
All right. What do you have for us today?
All right. We got a new study out by IES called U.S. States in a Global Context. This came out last week, so we're a little bit, I feel like we're late and we're not even a week out. But anyway, that's the news cycle. It examines how American eighth grade students compare to other kids around the globe. They use NAEP scores to predict performance on TIMSS, which is the international test that examines what kids know about their school curriculum. It includes 38 countries and 9 other educational systems. Bottom line, results are generally not so bad. Show that 8th grade students in 35 states outperform the international TIMSS average in math, and those in 46 states did so in science. The states that performed below the average in math included, let's play along, Oklahoma, Tennessee, West Virginia, and what else? Take a guess.
Alabama, but only because I can see your paper.
Alabama, right. and D.C. The countries that bested every state in math, no surprise, South Korea, Singapore, Taiwan. I'm still calling it Taiwan. Massachusetts did well, but not the best compared to the world. For instance, 19% of its eighth graders scored at the high level. That's compared to roughly 50%, which seems insane, 50% in Taiwan, Korea, and Singapore, who scored at the high level. As for science, 47 states were higher than the TIMSS average, and 3 states, Mississippi, Alabama, and D.C. again. We're lower. Six of the 10 of the top scores in science were in the U.S., including most of the Northeast, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, all in the top 10. In general, we fared better in science than math. I hate to get wonky, but just a couple caveats. NAEP and TIMSS measure very different things, so even if we can equate the scores through statistics, which we can do so, it doesn't mean that we're looking at the same concepts. NAEP tests mostly public school students. TIMSS also includes the private school kids. And the countries that were included are both developing and not so developing. So we got to keep in mind what our comparison is. But bottom line, our eighth graders, most pundits say that these results show they're globally competitive, but they're still lagging the world's highest performers. So there you have it.
That is interesting. And I know that, you know, some of this is stuff that we already knew that, you know, this, especially the states that perform at the bottom. But every time I see a 50 state or 51 state study like this, it always jumps out that D.C. is at the bottom. And because I taught in D.C., it consistently makes me a little bit angry, because is it fair to throw in D.C. with an entire state? Of course not.
I know. I get it. I don't know what to say about that. and they're going to hopefully be doing better, right? Because they've got some higher standards in place. But again, you know, when we're looking at TIMSS, I mean, nobody knows what TIMSS and NAEP really measure and how those concepts differ. So I don't know. I mean, these are really cool studies and they give us an insight, but I just get a little weird about what they're really comparing.
So
that's a researcher term. I get weird about this. So
then, I mean, obviously there's a reason to do them, because there is no single worldwide. I mean, how are you going to make these comparisons? But, you know, comparisons like this really are the basis of a lot of people in education saying that we have this push. We have to be internationally competitive. We have to do this. But I don't think anyone is really questioning the validity of the comparisons.
Yeah. Well, it just makes me wonder, though, if the headline in Ed Week was, you know, we are internationally competitive. We're just not the best of the best. Like, you know, what are some anti-school reformers going to do with that message? Because we've heard from a lot of folks on the left for a long time, there's no crisis in education. So you wonder, like, okay, what do these data really tell us? You know, is the bar been raised to, we want to be the best of the best? I mean, surely, but at least these data say, well, at least how we've defined average on TIMSS is where most of the nation is scoring.
And so as it relates to some of these other studies that show there is a crisis, if this study says, well, maybe there's a little bit less of a crisis, where do things shake out? What's your view on where we stand right now in math and science?
Yeah, I hate to like, you know, get into the weeds, but I really think it matters what tests we're talking about. Like, we talk about, oh, we don't like, you know, we're not real big proponents of PISA because it's mostly problem solving. We tend to like TIMSS because it's about real stuff. We tend to like NAEP because it can kind of give us a, you know, a good barometer of what proficiency means. So I think all these tests have different virtues. And I think that we have to keep in mind what each test is testing before we can say, okay, this is what it's showing. That's a wonky answer. Dara, what do you got on that one?
I agree. And I think a wonky answer is fine. That's what we do. Thank you for the summary. And until next week,
I'm Michael Brickman.
And I'm Dara Z. Handelar for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Happy Halloween. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.